Is it simply self-love? That's a good thing, but one mustn't make a virtue of it or a profession. Insofar as I love life, I love the hills of the domain of Esther. But that sort of love does not have a boundary line of hate. And beyond that, I am ignorant, I hope. Ignorant in the Handara sense, to ignore the abstraction, to hold fast to the thing. There was in this attitude something feminine, a refusal of the abstract, the ideal, a submissiveness to the given, which rather displeased me. Yet he added, scrupulous, a man who doesn't detest a bad government is a fool, and if there were such a thing as a good government on earth, it would be a great joy to serve it. There we understood each other. I know something of that joy, I said. Yes, so I judged. I rinsed our bowls with hot water and dumped the rinsings out the valve door of the tent. It was blind dark outside. Snow fell fine and thin, just visible in the oval, dim shaft of light from the valve. Sealed again in the dry warmth of the tent, we laid out our bags. He said something, "Give the bowls to me, Mr. I," or some such remark, and I said, "Is it going to be Mr., clear across the Gobrin ice?" He looked up and laughed. "I don't know what to call you. My name is Genli I. I know, you use my land name. I don't know what to call you either. Harth. Then I'm I. Who uses first names? Harth brothers or friends," he said, and saying it was remote, out of reach, 2 feet from me, in a tent 8 feet across. No answer to that. What is more arrogant than honesty? Cooled, I climbed into my fur bag. "Good night, I," said the alien, and the other alien said, "Good night, Harth." A friend. What is a friend, in a world where any friend may be a lover at a new phase of the moon? Not I, locked in my virility. No friend the Therum Harth, or any other of his race. Neither man nor woman, neither and both. Cyclic, lunar, metamorphosing under the hand's touch. Changelings in the human cradle, they were no flesh of mine, no friends, no love between us. We slept. I woke once and heard the snow ticking thick and soft on the tent. Estevan was up at dawn getting breakfast. The day broke bright. We loaded up and were off as the sun gilded the tops of the scrubby bushes rimming the dell, Estevan pulling in harness and I as pusher and rudder at the stern. The snow was beginning to get a crust on it. On clear downslopes we went like a dog team at a run. That day we skirted and then entered the forest that borders Pullifan Farm, the forest of dwarfs, thick-set, neural-limbed, ice-bearded Thor trees. We dared not use the main road north, but logging roads lent their direction to us sometimes for a while, and as the forest was kept clear of fallen trees and undergrowth, we got on well. Once we were in Taranpath, there were fewer ravines or steep ridges. The sledge meter at evening said 20 miles for the day's run, and we were less tired than the night before. One palliative of winter on winter is that the days stay light. The planet has a few degrees of tilt to the plane of the ecliptic, not enough to make an appreciable seasonal difference in low latitudes. Season is not a hemispheric effect, but a global one, a result of the ellipsoid orbit. At the far and slow-moving end of the orbit, approaching and departing from aphelion, there is just enough loss of solar radiation to disturb the already uneasy weather patterns, to chill down what is cold already, and turn the wet gray summer into white violent winter. Drier than the rest of the year, winter might be pleasanter if it were not for the cold. The sun, when you see it, shines high. There is no slow bleeding away of light into the darkness, as on the polar slopes of Earth, where cold and night come on together. Gethin has a bright winter, bitter, terrible, and bright. We were 3 days getting through Taranpath Forest. On the last, Estevan stopped and made camp early in order to set traps. He wanted to catch some pesthri. They are one of the larger land animals of winter, about the size of a fox, oviparous vegetarians with a splendid coat of gray or white fur. He was after the meat, for pesthrae are edible. They were migrating south in vast numbers. They are so light-footed and solitary that we saw only two or three as we hauled. But the snow was thick-starred in every glade of the Thor Forest, with countless little snowshoe tracks all heading south. Estevan's snares were full in an hour or two. He cleaned and cut up the six beasts, hung some of the meat to freeze, stewed some for our meal that night. Gathenians are not a hunting people, because there's very little to hunt. No large herbivores, thus no large carnivores, except in the teeming seas. They fish and farm. I had never before seen a Gathenian with blood on his hands. Estevan looked at the white pelts. There's a week's room and board for a pesthrae hunter, he said. Gone to waste. He held out one for me to touch. The fur was so soft and deep that you could not be certain when your hand began to feel it. Our sleeping bags, coats, and hoods were lined with that same fur, an unsurpassed insulator and very beautiful to see. Hardly seems worth it, I said, for a stew. Estevan gave me his brief, dark stare and said, "We need protein," and tossed away the pelts where, overnight, the Rusi, the fierce little rat snakes, would devour them and the entrails and the bones and lick clean the bloody snow. He was right. He was generally right. There was a pound or two of edible meat on a pesthrae. I ate my half of the stew that night and could have eaten his without noticing. Next morning, when we started up into the mountains, I was twice the sledge engine I had been. We went up that day. The beneficent snowfall and Croxet, windless weather, 0 degrees Fahrenheit and 20 degrees, that had seen us through Taranpeth and out of range of probable pursuit, now dissolved wretchedly into above-freezing temperatures and rain. Now I began to understand why Gathenians complain when the temperature rises in winter and cheer up when it falls. In the city, rain is an inconvenience. To a traveler, it is a catastrophe. We hauled that sledge up the flanks of the Sambentians all morning through a deep, cold porridge of rain-sodden snow. By afternoon, on steep slopes, the snow was mostly gone. Torrents of rain, miles of mud and gravel. We cased the runners, putting the wheels on the sledge, and hauled on up. As a wheeled cart, it was a bitch, sticking and tipping every moment. Dark fell before we found any shelter of cliff or cave to set up the tent in, so that despite all our care, things got wet. Estevan had said that a tent such as ours would house us pretty comfortably in any weather at all, so long as we kept it dry inside. Once you can't dry out your bags, you lose too much body heat all night, and you don't sleep well. Our food ration's too short to allow us to afford that. We can't count on any sunlight to dry things out, so we must not get them wet. I had listened, and had been as scrupulous as he about keeping snow and wet out of the tent, so that there was only the unavoidable moisture from our cooking and our lungs and pores to be evaporated. But this night everything was wet through before we could get the tent up. We huddled, steaming, over the chabi stove, and presently had a stew of pesthrae meat to eat, hot and solid, good enough almost to compensate for everything else. The sledge meter, ignoring the hard uphill work we had done all day, said we had come only 9 miles. "First day we've done less than our stint," I said. Estevan nodded and neatly cracked a leg bone for the marrow. He had stripped off his wet outer clothes and sat in shirt and breeches, barefoot, collar open. I was still too cold to take off my coat and yeb and boots. There he sat, cracking marrow bones, neat, tough, durable, his sleek, fur-like hair shedding the water like a bird's feathers. He dripped a little onto his shoulders, like house eaves dripping, and never noticed it. He was not discouraged. He belonged here. The first meat ration had given me some intestinal cramps, and that night they got severe. I lay awake in the soggy darkness, loud with rain. At breakfast, he said, "You had a bad night." "How did you know?" For he slept very deeply, scarcely moving even when I left the tent. He gave me that look again. What's wrong? Diarrhea? He winced and said savagely, It's the meat. I suppose so. My fault, I should... It's all right. Can you travel? Yes. Rain fell and fell. A west wind off the sea kept the temperature in the 30s, even here at 3,000 or 4,000 feet of altitude. We never saw more than a quarter mile ahead through the gray mist and mass of rain. What slopes rose on above us, I never looked up to see. Nothing to see but rain falling. We went by compass, keeping as much to northward as the cut and veer of the great slopes allowed. The glacier had been over these mountainsides in the hundreds of thousands of years it had been grinding back and forth across the north. There were tracks scored along granite slopes, long and straight, as if cut with a great U-gouge. We could pull a sledge along those scratches sometimes, as if along a road. I did best pulling. I could lean into the harness, and the work kept me warm. When we stopped for a bite of food at midday, I felt sick and cold and could not eat. We went on, climbing again now. Rain fell and fell and fell. Estevan stopped us under a great overhang of black rock along in mid-afternoon. He had the tent up almost before I was out of harness. He ordered me to go in and lie down. I'm all right, I said. You're not, he said. Go on. I obeyed, but I resented his tone. When he came into the tent with our night's needs, I sat up to cook, it being my turn. He told me in the same peremptory tone to lie still. You needn't order me about, I said. I'm sorry, he said inflexibly, his back turned. I'm not sick, you know. No, I didn't know. If you won't say, frankly, I must go by your looks. You haven't recovered your strength, and the going has been hard. I don't know where your limits lie. I'll tell you when I reach them. I was galled by his patronizing. He was a head shorter than I, and built more like a woman than a man, more fat than muscle. When we hauled together, I had to shorten my pace to his, hold in my strength, so as not to outpull him. A stallion in harness with a mule. You're no longer ill, then? No, of course, I'm tired. So are you. Yes, I am, he said. I was anxious about you. We have a long way to go. He had not meant to patronize. He had thought me sick, and sick men take orders. He was frank, and expected a reciprocal frankness that I might not be able to supply. He, after all, had no standards of manliness, of virility, to complicate his pride. On the other hand, if he could lower all his standards of Shifgrathor, as I realized he had done with me, perhaps I could dispense with the more competitive elements of my masculine self-respect, which he certainly understood as little as I understood Shifgrathor. How much of it did we cover today? He looked around and smiled a little gently. 6 miles, he said. The next day we did 7 miles, the next day 12, and the day after that we came out of the rain, out of the clouds, and out of the regions of mankind. It was the 9th day of our journey. We were 5,000 to 6,000 feet above sea level now, on a high plateau full of the evidences of recent mountain building and volcanism. We were in the fire hills of the Sembenchen Range. The plateau narrowed gradually to a valley, and the valley to a pass between long ridges. As we approached the end of the pass, the rain clouds were thinning and rending. A cold north wind dispersed them utterly, laying bare the peaks above the ridges to our right and left, basalt and snow, piebald and patchwork of black and white, brilliant under the sudden sun in a dazzling sky. Ahead of us, cleared and revealed by the same vast sweep of the wind, lay twisted valleys hundreds of feet below, full of ice and boulders. Across those valleys a great wall stood, a wall of ice, and raising our eyes up and still up to the rim of the wall, we saw the ice itself, the Gobrin Glacier, blinding and horizonless to the utmost north, a white the eyes could not look on. Here and there, out of the valleys full of rubble and out of the cliffs and bends and masses of the great ice field's edge, black ridges rose. One great mass loomed up out of the plateau to the height of the gateway peaks we stood between, and from its side drifted heavily a mile-long wisp of smoke. Farther off there were others, peaks, pinnacles, black cinder cones on the glacier. Smoke panted from fiery mouths that opened out of the ice. Estrovan stood there in harness beside me, looking at that magnificent and unspeakable desolation. "I'm glad I have lived to see this," he said. I felt as he did. It is good to have an end to journey towards, but it is the journey that matters in the end. It had not rained here on these north-facing slopes. Snowfields stretched down from the pass into the valleys of moraine. We stowed the wheels, uncapped the sledge runners, put on our skis, and took off. Down, north, onward, into that silent vastness of fire and ice that said in enormous letters of black and white, "Death. Death." Written right across the continent. The sledge pulled like a feather, and we laughed with joy. Chapter 16. Between Drumner and Drumigol. Adne Thern. I asks from his sleeping bag, "What is it you're writing, Harth?" "A record." He laughs a little. "I ought to be keeping a journal for the ecumenical files, but I never could stick to it without a voice writer. I explained that my notes are intended for my people at Esther, who will incorporate them as they see fit into the records of the domain. This, turning my thoughts to my hearth and my son, I seek to turn them away again and ask, "Your parent, your parents, that is, are they alive?" "No," says I, 70 years dead." I puzzled at it. I was not 30 years old. "You're counting years of a different length than ours?" "No. Oh, I see. I've time-jumped. 20 years from Earth to Hain Davenant, from 50 to Elul, from Elul to here 17. I've only lived off Earth 7 years, but I was born there 120 years ago." Long since, in Erenrang, he had explained to me how time is shortened inside the ships that go almost as fast as starlight between the stars. But I had not laid this fact down against the length of a man's life, or the lives he leaves behind him on his own world. While he lived a few hours in one of those unimaginable ships going from one planet to another, everyone he had left behind him at home grew old and died, and their children grew old. I said at last, "I thought myself an exile." "You for my sake? I for yours," he said, and laughed again, a slight cheerful sound in the heavy silence. "These 3 days since we came down from the pass have been much hard work for no gain, but I is no longer downcast nor overhopeful, and he has more patience with me. Maybe the drugs are sweated out of him. Maybe we have learned to pull together." We spent this day coming down from the basaltic spur which we spent yesterday climbing. From the valley it looked a good road up onto the ice, but the higher we went, the more scree and slick rock face we met, and a grade ever steeper, till even without the sledge we could not have climbed it. Tonight we are back down at the foot of it in the moraine, the valley of stones. Nothing grows here. Rock, pebble dump, boulder fields, clay, mud. An arm of the glacier has withdrawn from this slope within the last 50 or 100 years, leaving the planet's bones raw to the air. No flesh of earth, of grass. Here and there fumaroles cast a heavy yellowish fog over the ground, low and creeping. The air smells of sulfur. It is 12 degrees, still, overcast. I hope no heavy snow falls until we have got over the evil ground between this place and the glacier arm we saw some miles to the west from the ridge. It seems to be a wide ice river running down from the plateau between two mountains, volcanoes, both capped with steam and smoke. If we can get onto it from the slopes of the nearer volcano, it may provide us a road up onto the plateau of ice. To our east, a smaller glacier comes down to a frozen lake, but it runs curving, and even from here the great crevasses in it can be seen. It is impassable to us, equipped as we are. We agreed to try the glacier between the volcanoes, though by going west to it we lose at least 2 days' mileage towards our goal, one in going west and one in regaining the distance. Opposite Thern, snowing, Nesserum. Nesserum, fine snow on a moderate gale, a light blizzard. No travel in this. We both slept all day. We have been hauling nearly a half month. The sleep does us good. Ottermanbad Thern, snowing, Nesserum. Enough sleep. I taught me a Terran game played on squares with little stones called Go, an excellent, difficult game. As he remarked, there are plenty of stones here to play Go with. He endures the cold pretty well, and if courage were enough, would stand it like a snowworm. It is odd to see him bundled up in Hieban overcoat with the hood up when the temperature is above zero. But when we sledge, if the sun is out, or the wind not too bitter, he takes off the coat soon and sweats like one of us. We must compromise as to the heating of the tent. He would keep it hot, I cold. And either's comfort is the other's pneumonia. We strike a medium, and he shivers outside his bag while I swelter in mine. But considering from what distances we have come together to share this tent a while, we do well enough. Gethany Thonern. Clear after the blizzard. Wind down, the thermometer around 15 degrees all day. We are camped on the lower western slope of the nearer volcano, Mount Dremagol, on my map of Orgrin. Its companion across the ice river is called Drumner. The map is poorly made. There is a great peak visible to the west, not shown on it at all, and it is all out of proportion. The Argata evidently do not often come into their fire hills. Indeed, there is not much to come for except grandeur. We hauled 11 miles today, difficult work, all rock. I is asleep already. I bruised the tendon of my heel, wrenching it like a fool when my foot was caught between two boulders, and limped out the afternoon. The night's rest should heal it. Tomorrow we should get down onto the glacier. Our food supplies seem to have sunk alarmingly, but it is because we have been eating the bulky stuff. We had between 90 and 100 pounds of coarse foodstuffs, half of it the load I stole in Taraf. 60 pounds of this are gone, after 15 days' journey. I have started on the Gitche Mitche at a pound a day, saving 2 sacks of Kadig germ, some sugar, and a chest of dried fish cakes for variety later. I'm glad to be rid of that heavy stuff from Turif. The sledge pulls lighter. Sordni Thonern, in the 20s. Frozen rain, wind pouring down the ice river like the draft in a tunnel. Camped a quarter mile in from the edge on a long, flat streak of fern. The way down from Dremagol was rough and steep on bare rock and rock fields. The glacier's edge heavily crevassed and so foul with gravel and rocks caught in the ice that we tried the sledge on wheels there, too. Before we had got 100 yards, a wheel wedged fast and the axle bent. We use runners henceforth. We made only 4 miles today, still in the wrong direction. The effluent glacier seems to run on a long curve westerly up to the Gobrin Plateau. Here, between the volcanoes, it is about 4 miles wide, and should not be hard going farther in towards the center, though it is more crevassed than I had hoped, and the surface rotten. Drumner is in eruption. The sleet on one's lips tastes of smoke and sulfur. A darkness lowered all day in the west, even under the rain clouds. From time to time, all things, clouds, icy rain, ice, air, would turn a dull red, then fade slowly back to gray. The glacier shakes a little under our feet. Eskishwi Rem Irher hypothesized that the volcanic activity in northwest Orgrun and the archipelago has been increasing during the last 10 or 20 millennia and presages the end of the ice, or at least a recession of it and an interglacial period. CO2 released by the volcanoes into the atmosphere will in time serve as an insulator, holding in the long wave heat energy reflected from the Earth, while permitting direct solar heat to enter undiminished. The average world temperature, he says, would in the end be raised some 30 degrees, till it attains 72 degrees. I am glad I shall not be present. I says that similar theories have been propounded by Terran scholars to explain the still incomplete recession of their last age of ice. All such theories remain largely irrefutable and unprovable. No one knows certainly why the ice comes, why it goes. The snow of ignorance remains untrodden. Over Drumner, in the dark now, a great table of dull fire burns. Epsthanern. The meter reads 16 miles hall today, but we are not more than 8 miles in a straight line from last night's camp. We are still in the ice pass between the two volcanoes. Drumner is in eruption. Worms of fire crawl down its black sides, seen when wind clears off the roil and seethe of ash cloud and smoke cloud and white steam. Continuously, with no pause, a hissing mutter fills the air, so huge and so long a sound that one cannot hear it when one stops to listen. Yet it fills all the interstices of one's being. The glacier trembles perpetually, snaps and crashes, jitters under our feet. All the snow bridges that the blizzard may have laid across crevasses are gone, shaken down, knocked in by this drumming and jumping of the ice and the earth beneath the ice. We go back and forth, seeking the end of a slit in the ice that would swallow the sledge whole, then seeking the end of the next, trying to go north, and forced always to go west or east. Above us, Dremagol, in sympathy with Drumner's labor, grumbles and farts foul smoke. I's face was badly frostbitten this morning. Nose, ears, chin, all dead gray when I chanced to look at him. Needed him back to life and no damage done, but we must be more careful. The wind that blows down off the ice is, in simple truth, deadly, and we have to face it as we haul. I shall be glad to get off this slit and wrinkled ice arm between two growling monsters. Mountains should be seen, not heard. Arhad Thonern. Some sov snow between 15 and 20 degrees. We went 12 miles today, about 5 of them profitable, and the rim of the Gobrin is visibly nearer north above us. We now see the ice river to be miles wide. The arm between Drumner and Dremagol is only 1 finger, and we now are on the back of the hand. Turning and looking down from this camp, one sees the glacier flow split, divided, torn, and churned by the black steaming peaks that thwart it. Looking ahead, one sees it broaden, rising and curving slowly, dwarfing the dark ridges of earth, meeting the ice wall far above under veils of cloud and smoke and snow. Cinders and ash now fall with the snow, and the ice is thick with clinkers on it or sunk in it. A good walking surface, but rather rough for hauling, and the runners need recoating already. 2 or 3 times volcanic projectiles hit the ice quite near us. They hiss loudly as they strike, and burn themselves a socket in the ice. Cinders patter, falling with the snow. We creep infinitesimally northward through the dirty chaos of a world in the process of making itself. Praise then creation unfinished. Netherhad Thonern. No snow since morning. overcast and windy at about 15 degrees. The great multiple glacier we are on feeds down into the valley from the west, and we are on its extreme eastern edge. Dremagol and Drumner are now somewhat behind us, though a sharp ridge of Dremagol still rises east of us almost at eye level. We have crept and crawled up to a point where we must choose between following the glacier on its long sweep westward and so up gradually onto the plateau of ice, or climbing the ice cliffs a mile north of tonight's camp, and so saving 20 or 30 miles of hauling, at the cost of risk. I favors the risk. There is a frailty about him. He is all unprotected, exposed, vulnerable, even to his sexual organ, which he must carry always outside himself. But he is strong, unbelievably strong. I am not sure he can keep hauling any longer than I can, but he can haul harder and faster than I, twice as hard. He can lift the sledge at front or rear to ease it over an obstacle. I could not lift and hold that weight, unless I was in Dothy. To match his frailty and strength, he has a spirit easy to despair and quick to defiance, a fierce, impatient courage. This slow, hard, crawling work we have been doing these days wears him out in body and will, so that if he were one of my race, I should think him a coward. But he is anything but that. He has a ready bravery I have never seen the like of. He is ready, eager, to stake life on the cruel, quick test of the precipice. Fire and fear, good servants, bad lords. He makes fear serve him. I would have let fear lead me around by the long way. Courage and reason are with him. What good seeking the safe course on a journey such as this? There are senseless courses, which I shall not take, but there is no safe one. Streth Thonern. No luck, no way to get the sledge up, though we spent the day at it. Sove snow in flurries, thick ash mixed with it. It was dark all day as the wind veering around from the west again blew the pall of Drumner's smoke on us. Up here the ice shakes less, but there came a great quake while we tried to climb a shelving cliff. It shook free the sledge where we had wedged it, and I was pulled down 5 or 6 feet with a bump. But I had a good handhold, and his strength saved us from all careering down to the foot of the cliff, 20 feet or more. If one of us breaks a leg or shoulder in these exploits, that is probably the end of both of us. There, precisely, is the risk. Rather an ugly one when looked at closely. The lower valley of the glaciers behind us is white with steam. Lava touches ice down there. We certainly cannot go back. Tomorrow we shall try the ascent further west. Baron Thonern. No luck. We must go farther west. Dark as late twilight all day. Our lungs are raw, not from cold. It remains well above zero even at night with this west wind, but from breathing the ash and fumes of the eruption. By the end of this second day of wasted effort, scrabbling and squirming over pressure blocks and up ice cliffs, always to be stopped by a sheer face or overhang, trying farther on and failing again, I was exhausted and enraged. He looked ready to cry, but did not. I believe he considers crying either evil or shameful. Even when he was very ill and weak, the first days of our escape, he hid his face from me when he wept. Reasons personal, racial, social, sexual, how can I guess why I must not weep? Yet his name is a cry of pain. For that I first sought him out in Erenrong a long time ago, it seems now. Hearing talk of an alien, I asked his name, and heard for answer a cry of pain from a human throat across the night. Now he sleeps. His arms tremble and twitch, muscular fatigue. The world around us, ice and rock, ash and snow, fire and dark, trembles and twitches and mutters. Looking out a minute ago, I saw the glow of the volcano as a dull red bloom on the belly of vast clouds overhanging the darkness. Orny Thonnern. No luck. This is the 22nd day of our journey, and since the 10th day we have made no progress eastward. Indeed, have lost 20 or 25 miles by going west. Since the 18th day, we have made no progress of any kind, and might as well have sat still. If we ever do get up on the ice, will we have food enough left to take us across it? This thought is hard to dismiss. Fog and murk of the eruption cut seeing very close, so that we cannot choose our path well. I wants to attack each ascent, however steep, that shows any sign of shelving. He is impatient with my caution. We have got to watch our tempers. I will be in Kemmer in a day or so, and all strains will increase. Meanwhile, we butt our heads on cliffs of ice in a cold dusk full of ashes. If I wrote a new Yomish canon, I should send thieves here after death. Thieves who steal sacks of food by night and turf. Thieves who steal a man's hearth and name from him, and send him out ashamed and exiled. My head is thick. I must cross out all this stuff later. Too tired to reread it now. Harhahad Thonnern. On the Gobrin. The 23rd day of our journey. We are on the Gobrin ice. As soon as we set out this morning, we saw, only a few hundred yards beyond last night's camp, a pathway open up to the ice. A highway curving, broad, and cinder-paved from the rubble and chasms of the glacier right up through the cliffs of ice. We walked up it as if strolling along the Sess embankment. We are on the ice. We are headed east again, homeward. I am infected by eyes' pure pleasure in our achievement. Looked at soberly, it is as bad as ever up here. We are on the plateau's rim, crevasses, some wide enough to sink villages in, not house by house, but all at once, run inland, northward, right out of sight. Most of them cut across our way, so we too must go north, not east. The surface is bad. We screw the sledge along amongst great lumps and chunks of ice, immense debris pushed up by the straining of the great plastic sheet of ice against and among the fire hills. The broken pressure ridges take queer shapes, overturned towers, legless giants, catapults. A mile thick to start with, the ice here rises and thickens, trying to flow over the mountains and choke the fire mouths with silence. Some miles to the north, a peak rises up out of the ice, the sharp, graceful, barren cone of a young volcano. Younger by thousands of years than the ice sheet that grinds and shoves, all shattered into chasms and jammed up into great blocks and ridges over the 6,000 feet of lower slopes we cannot see. During the day, turning, we saw the smoke of Drumner's eruption hang behind us like a gray-brown extension of the surface of the ice. A steady wind blows along at ground level from the northeast, clearing this higher air of the soot and stink of the planet's bowels, which we have breathed for days, flattening out the smoke behind us to cover, like a dark lid, the glaciers, the lower mountains, the valleys of stones, the rest of the earth. There is nothing, the ice says, but ice. But the young volcano there to the northward has another word it thinks of saying. No snowfall, a thin, high, overcast, 4 degrees below zero, on the plateau at dusk. A jumble of fern, new ice, and old ice underfoot. The new ice is tricky, slick blue stuff, just hidden by a white glaze. We have both been down a good deal. I slid 15 feet on my belly across one such slick. I, in harness, doubled up laughing. He apologized and explained he had thought himself the only person on Geffen who ever slipped on ice. 13 miles today, but if we try to keep up such a pace, among these cut, heaped, crevassed pressure ridges, we shall wear ourselves out, or come to worse grief than a belly slide. The waxing moon is low, dull as dry blood. A great brownish, iridescent halo surrounds it. Gurney Thonnern, some snow, rising wind, and falling temperature. 13 miles again today, which brings our distance logged since we left our first camp to 254 miles. We have averaged about 10.5 miles a day, 11.5, omitting the 2 days spent waiting out the blizzard. 75 to 100 of those miles of hauling gave us no onward gain. We are not much nearer Carhide than we were when we set out. But we stand a better chance, I think, of getting there. Since we came up out of the volcano murk, our spirit is not all spent in work and worry, and we talk again in the tent after our dinner. As I am in Kemmer, I would find it easier to ignore I's presence, but this is difficult in a two-man tent. The trouble is, of course, that he is, in his curious fashion, also in Kemmer. Always in Kemmer. A strange, low-grade sort of desire it must be, to be spread out over every day of the year, and never to know the choice of sex. But there it is, and here am I.